Chapter 7. To Hannibal, and enlisting in a private company, composed mainly of old schoolmates, went soldiering for two rainy, inglorious weeks, by the end of which he had had enough of war, and furthermore had discovered that he was more of a Union abolitionist than a slave-holding secessionist, as he had at first supposed. Convictions were likely to be rather infirm during those early days of the war, and subject to change without notice. Especially was this so in the border state. 3. Letters 1861-62. On the Frontier. Mining Adventures. Journalistic beginnings. Clemens went from the battlefront to Keokuk, where Orion was preparing to accept the appointment prophesied by Madame Caprell. Orion was a staunch Unionist, and a member of Lincoln's cabinet had offered him the secretaryship of the new territory of Nevada. Orion had accepted, and only needed funds to carry him to his destination. His pilot brother had the funds, and upon being appointed private secretary, agreed to pay both passages on the overland stage, which would bear them across the Great Plains from St. Joe to Carson City. Mark Twain, in Roughing It, has described that glorious journey and the frontier life that followed it. His letters form a supplement of realism to a tale that is more or less fictitious, though marvelously true in color and background. The first bears no date, but it was written not long after their arrival, August 14, 1861. It is not complete, but there is enough of it to give us a very fair picture of Carson City, a wooden town, its population 2,000 souls. Part of a letter to Mrs. Jane Clemens, in St. Louis. Date not given, but September, or October, 1861. My dear mother, I hope you will all come out here someday. But I shan't consent to invite you, until we can receive you in style. But I guess we shall be able to do that, one of these days. I intend that Pamela shall live on Lake Bigler until she can knock a bull down with her fist, say, about 3 months. Tell everything as it is, no better, and no worse. Well, Gold Hill sells at $5,000 per foot. Cash down semicolon Wildcat isn't worth 10 cents. The country is fabulously rich in gold, silver, copper, lead, coal, iron, quicksilver, marble, granite, chalk, plaster of Paris, gypsum, thieves, murderers, desperados, ladies, children, lawyers, Christians, Indians, Chinamen, Spaniards, gamblers, sharpers, coyotes, pronounced coyotes, poets, preachers, and jackass rabbits. I overheard a gentleman say, the other day, that it was PD-S country under the sun. And that comprehensive conception I fully subscribe to. It never rains here, and the dew never falls. No flowers grow here, and no green thing gladdens the eye. The birds that fly over the land carry their provisions with them. Only the crow and the raven tarry with us. Our city lies in the midst of a desert of the purest, most unadulterated, and compromising sand in which infernal soil nothing but that fag end of vegetable creation, sagebrush, ventures to grow. If you will take a Lilliputian cedar tree for a model, and build a dozen imitations of it with the stiffest article of telegraph wire, set them 1 foot apart, and then try to walk through them, you'll understand, provided the floor is covered 12 inches deep with sand, what it is to wander through a sagebrush desert. When crushed, sagebrush emits an odor which isn't exactly magnolia and equally isn't exactly polecat, but is a sort of compromise between the two. It looks a good deal like greasewood, and is the ugliest plant that was ever conceived of. It is gray in color. On the plains, sagebrush and greasewood grow about twice as large as the common geranium, and in my opinion they are a very good substitute for that useless vegetable. Greasewood is a perfect-most perfect imitation in miniature of a live oak tree, barring the color of it. As to the other fruits and flowers of the country, there ain't any, except euler, or whatever they call it, a species of unpoetical willow, that grows on the banks of the Carson, a river, 20 yards wide, knee-deep, and so villainously rapid and crooked, that it looks like it had wandered into the country without intending it, and had run about in a bewildered way and got lost, in its hurry to get out again before some thirsty man came along, and drank it up. I said we are situated in a flat, sandy desert, true, and surrounded on all sides by such prodigious mountains, that when you gaze at them a while, and begin to conceive of their grandeur and next to feel their vastness expanding your soul and ultimately find yourself growing and swelling and spreading into a giant, I say when this point is reached, you look disdainfully down upon the insignificant village of Carson, and in that instant you are seized with a burning desire to stretch forth your hand, put the city in your pocket, and walk off with it. As to churches, I believe they have got a Catholic one here, but like that one the New York fireman spoke of, I believe they don't run her now. Now, although we are surrounded by sand, the greatest part of the town is built upon what was once a very pretty grassy spot, and the streams of pure water that used to poke about it in rural sloth and solitude now pass through on moldy streets, and gladden the hearts of men by reminding them that there is at least something here that hath its prototype among the homes they left behind them. And up in's Canon, please pronounce Canyon, after the manner of the natives, there are ranches, farms, where they say hay grows, and grass, and beets and onions, and turnips, and other ruck which is suitable for cows, yes, and even Irish potatoes. Also, cabbage, peas and beans. The houses are mostly frame, unplastered, but apered inside with flour sacks sewed together, and the handsomer the brand upon the sacks is, the neater the house looks. Occasionally, you stumble on a stone house. On account of the dryness of the country, the shingles on the houses warp till they look like short joints of stovepipe split lengthwise. Remainder missing. And this letter is something of the ill freedom of the West, which later would contribute to his fame. The spirit of the frontier of Mark Twain was beginning to stir him. There had been no secretary work for him to do, and no provision for payment. He found his profit in studying human nature and in prospecting native resources. He was not interested in mining, not yet. With a boy named John Kinney he made an excursion to Lake Bigler, now Tahoe, and located a timber claim, really of great value. They were supposed to build a fence around it, but they were too full of the enjoyment of camp life to complete it. They put in most of their time wandering through the stately forest or drifting over the transparent lake in a boat left there by lumbermen. They built themselves a brush house, but they did not sleep in it. In roughing it, he writes, it never occurred to us, for one thing, and, besides, it was built to hold the ground, and that was enough. We did not wish to strain it. They were having a glorious time, when their campfire got away from them, and burned up their claim. His next letter, of which the beginning is missing, describes the fire. Fragment of a letter to Mrs. Jane Clemens and Mrs. Moffat, in St. Louis. The level ranks of flame were relieved at intervals by the standard dash bearers, as we called the tall dead trees, wrapped in fire, and waving their blazing banners 100 feet in the air. Then we could turn from this scene to the lake, and see every branch, and leaf, and cataract of flame upon its bank perfectly reflected as in a gleaming, fiery mirror. The mighty roaring of the conflagration, together with our solitary and somewhat unsafe position, for there was no one within 6 miles of us, rendered the scene very impressive. Occasionally, one of us would remove his pipe from his mouth and say, "Superb, magnificent, beautiful. But by the Lord God Almighty, if we attempt to sleep in this little patch tonight, we'll never live till morning. For if we don't burn up, we'll certainly suffocate." But he was persuaded to sit up until we felt pretty safe as far as the fire was concerned, and then we turned in, with many misgivings. When we got up in the morning, we found that the fire had burned small pieces of driftwood within 6 feet of our boat, and had made its way to within 4 or 5 steps of us on the south side. We looked like lava men, covered as we were with ashes, and begrimed with smoke. We were very black in the face, but we soon washed ourselves white again. John D. Kinney, a Cincinnati boy, and a first-rate fellow too, who came out with Judge Turner, was my comrade. We stayed at the lake 4 days. I had plenty of fun, for John constantly reminded me of Sam Bowen when we were on our campaign in Missouri. But first and foremost, for Annie's, Molly's, and Pamela's comfort, be it known that I have never been guilty of profane language since I have been in this territory, and Kinney hardly ever swears. But sometimes human nature gets the better of him. On the second day we started to go by land to the lower camp, a distance of 3 miles, over the mountains, each carrying an axe. I don't think we got lost exactly, but we wandered 4 hours over the steepest, rockiest and most dangerous piece of country in the world. I couldn't keep from laughing at Kinney's distress, so I kept behind, so that he could not see me. After he would get over a dangerous place, with infinite labor and constant apprehension, he would stop, lean on his axe, and look around, then behind, then ahead, and then drop his head and ruminate a while. Then he would draw a long sigh, and say, "Well, could any billigit have scaled that place without breaking his neck?" And I would reply, "No, I don't think he could." "Oh, you don't think he could?" mimicking me. "Why don't you curse the infernal place? You know you want to." "I do, and will curse the thieving country as long as I live." Then we would toil on in silence for a while. Finally I told him, "John, what if we don't find our way out of this today? We'll know all about the country when we do get out." I know enough and too much about the D-D villainous locality already. Finally, we reached the camp. But as we brought no provisions with us, the first subject that presented itself to us was how to get back. John swore he wouldn't walk back, so we rolled a drift log apiece into the lake and set about making paddles, intending to straddle the logs and paddle ourselves back home sometime or other. But the lake objected, got stormy, and we had to give it up. So we set out for the only house on this side of the lake, 3 miles from there, down the shore. We found the way without any trouble, reached there before sundown, played 3 games of cribbage, borrowed a dugout and pulled back 6 miles to the upper camp. As we had eaten nothing since sunrise, we did not waste time in cooking our supper or in eating it either. After supper we got out our pipes, built a rousing campfire in the open air, established a faro bank, an institution of this country, on our huge flat granite dining table, and bet white beans till 1 o'clock, when John went to bed. We were up before the sun the next morning, went out on the lake, and caught a fine trout for breakfast. But unfortunately, I spoiled part of the breakfast. We had coffee and tea boiling on the fire, in coffee pots, and fearing they might not be strong enough, I added more ground coffee, and more tea, but you know mistakes will happen. I put the tea in the coffee pot, and the coffee in the teapot, and if you imagine that they were not villainous mixtures, just try the effect once. And so Bella's to be married on the 1st of October. Well, I send her and her husband my very best wishes, and I may not be here, but wherever I am on that night, we'll have a rousing campfire and a jollification in honor of the event. In a day or two we shall probably go to the lake and build another cabin and fence, and get everything into satisfactory trim before our trip to Esmeralda about the 1st of November. What has become of Sam Bowen? I would give my last shirt to have him out here. I will make no promises, but I believe if John would give him $1,000 and send him out here he would not regret it. He might possibly do very well here, but he could do little without capital. Remember me to all my St. Louis and Keokuk friends, and tell Charlie and Allie Renson that I heard a military band play "Hadar the Wild Wave Saying" the other night, and it reminded me very forcibly of them. It brought Ella Creel and Belle across the desert to in an instant, for they sang the song in Orion's Yard the first time I ever heard it. It was like meeting an old friend. I tell you, I could have swallowed that whole band, trombone and all, if such a compliment would have been any gratification to them. Love to the young folks, Sam. The reference in the foregoing letter to Esmeralda has to do with mining plans. He was beginning to be mildly interested, and, with his brother Orion, had acquired Eden and Esmeralda Camp, probably at a very small price, so small as to hold out no exciting prospect of riches. In his next letter he gives us the size of this claim, which he has visited. His interest, however, still appears to be chiefly in his timber claim on Lake Bigler, Tahoe, though we are never to hear of it again after this letter. To Mrs. Moffat, in St. Louis, Carson City, October 25, 1861. My dear sister, I have just finished reading your letter and Ma's of September 8th. How in the world could they have been so long coming? You ask me if I have forgotten my promise to lay a claim for Mr. Moffat. By no means. I have already laid a timber claim on the borders of a Lake Bigler, which throws Como in the shade, and if we succeed in getting one Mr. Jones to move his sawmill up there, Mr. Moffat can just consider that claim better than bank stock. Jones says he will move his mill up next spring. And that claim I took up about 2 miles in length by 1 in width, and the names in it are as follows: : Sam, 50, Clemens, W.M., A. Moffat, Thos, Nye, and 3 others. It is situated on Clemens Bay, so named by Captain Nye, and it goes by that name among the inhabitants of that region. I had better stop about the lake, though, for whenever I think of it, I want to go there and die. The place is so beautiful. I'll build a country seat there one of these days that will make the devil's mouth water if he ever visits the earth. Jim Lampton will never know whether I laid a claim there for him or not until he comes here himself. We have now got about 1,650 feet of mining ground, and if it proves good, Mr. Moffat's name will go in. If not, I can get feet for him in the spring, which will be good. You see, Pamela, the trouble does not consist in getting mining ground, for that is plenty enough, but the money to work it with after you get it is the mischief. When I was in Esmeralda, a young fellow gave me 50 feet in the Lack Warrior, an unprospected claim. The other day he wrote me that he had gone down 8 feet on the ledge and found it 8 feet thick and pretty good rock too. He said he could take out rock now if there were a mill to crush it, but the mills are all engaged. There are only 4 of them, so if I were willing, he would suspend work until spring. I wrote him to let it alone at present because, you see, in the spring I can go down myself and help him look after it. There will then be 20 mills there. Orion and I have confidence enough in this country to think that, if the war will let us alone, we can make Mr. Moffat rich without its ever costing him a cent of money or particle of trouble. We shall lay plenty of claims for him, but if they never pay him anything, they will never cost him anything. Orion and I are not financiers. Therefore, you must persuade Uncle Jim to come out here and help us in that line. I have written to him twice to come. I wrote him today. In both letters I told him not to let you or Ma know that we dealt in such romantic nonsense as brilliant prospects, because I always did hate for anyone to know what my plans or hopes or prospects were, for if I kept people in ignorance in these matters, no one could be disappointed but myself if they were not realized. You know I never told you that I went on the river under a promise to pay Bixby $500 until I had paid the money and cleared my skirts of the possibility of having my judgment criticized. I would not say anything about our prospects now if we were nearer home, but I suppose at this distance you are more anxious than you would be if you saw us every month, and therefore it is hardly fair to keep you in the dark. However, keep these matters to yourselves, and then if we fail, we'll keep the laugh in the family. What we want now is something that will commence paying immediately. We have got a chance to get into a claim where they say a tunnel has been run 150 feet and the ledge struck. I got a horse yesterday, and went out with the attorney general, and the claim owner, and we tried to go to the claim by a new route, and got lost in the mountains. Sunset overtook us. Before we found the claim, my horse got too lame to carry me, and I got down, and drove him ahead of me till within 4 miles of town. Then we sent Rice on ahead. Bunker, whose horse was in good condition, undertook to lead mine, and I followed after him. Darkness shut him out from my view in less than a minute, and within the next minute I lost the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.